Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, folks, to Hamp's Corner of America, a corner where your host, Codis Hampton II, hangs out with notable guests discussing topics of interest to you and yours. Milwaukee's 13th and Juno is where our host grew up, where his creativity and his imagination originated. Hamp's Corner of America is where we discuss, debate, and innovate. In the end, we will all leave with a sense of purpose. So come on, hang out with us. And now your host, Codis Hampton II.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am Hamp. Here at the corner, we're pleased that you're taking the time to check us out. We are old school here, without disregarding the contributions of hip-hop to our current state of being. You will find that we often refer back to our past, as we do believe that if you do not know where you came from, you most certainly will not get to where you want to go. It is our hope that you will hang with us and our guest of the hour, and even contribute to the discussion, so that we may leave here having gained, or at the very least, enhanced our perspective on the topics of today. And by all means, have fun while doing so. Without further ado, let's get deep into it. All right. Hello, 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 folks. Welcome to the show. I'm glad you're taking the time to join us. Now, this program is brought to you by Hamp's Corner of America parent company, the Chia Group. You can check us out at www.chia.com, where you will also find how to order my latest book entitled Gracie Hall Hampton, The Arkansas Years, 1917 to 1953. You can also find my blogs on a regular basis at www.katara-rhythm.com. That's katara-rhythm.com. Hey, Rick, welcome to the show.
All right, Ham, good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our special guest is Rick Whitlow, the author of Swagger, The Life and Times of Rick Whitlow. So I'm glad we got you on, man.
Well, I tell you know, I've been looking forward to this for a couple of weeks, and it's funny that we finally get together on the show here, and we're down here in Atlanta getting ready to buckle in. It's starting to get a little chilly down here, Hamp. Like I tell you, I may have to move a little further south, a little someplace a little closer to the equator.
I hear that. I hear that. So how's the family and everybody?
Everybody's doing really good. Of course, getting ready for the holidays coming up, that's always a great time of year. So everything's peaceful and calm here. So looking forward to the holidays coming up.
That's good. I mean, this is one of my favorite times of the year, these holidays, and especially New Year's. You know, everything is new, so we'll see.
That's right. That's right. Looking forward to 2015. A lot of things out there.
That's right, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, enough of the general chit-chat. Let's get on with it. I know you've been an entrepreneur involved in Rick Whitlow Enterprises for the last 6 years. Can you tell us a little bit about what that entails?
Well, yeah, you know, one thing that happened, of course, most of my career has been spent in the broadcast journalism industry, 25, almost 30 years of working in front of the camera as a sports anchor and news anchor and the things that come and go with that. And one thing that has been really good about that profession is that the skill set that you develop is one that you can use to do many, many other things. So I was fortunate enough to, after, 20-some years, 25 years or so in front of that camera and doing that, working days, nights, holidays, weekends, everything, you reach a point where the thrill of just being on TV will kind of leave you. But you look back at is that you have developed some skills, some communication skills, writing, reading, being able to speak, and you can use that to parlay it into other things. And that's kind of what I did, Ham. Just kind of look for other opportunities because that TV business, that's a rough business. I mean, you kind of live from contract to contract and management to management, and when they get tired of you, they just, they will tell you your contract's not being renewed. So you always have to kind of develop, and I encourage young journalists, I said, don't get so caught up in being on TV that you get blindsided by a management change or a boss problem. Develop those other skills when you're out there covering these stories. Find out who the CEO is. Find out who the mayor is or the governor or whomever it might be, because you may need to call them somewhere down the road.
That's right.
Yeah, that's kind of what the Enterprises does. I've just kind of branched out from broadcast journalism and gotten into public relations, public affairs, doing a little tutoring and teaching and things of that nature. So that's the enterprising part of it.
Okay. All right. I know you are also a blogger, where your works can be found on hubpages.com. What are some of the subjects that you cover there, and do you feel that blogging keeps you current with today's events?
Well, it really does, and it also helps me keep my writing skills and reading skills sharp. I think I have on Hub Pages at this particular point, I have, I think, 12 articles on, and ironically, one of them is about the black community and police officers and law enforcement.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, in fact, there's a graphic that I use that has the Warner Brothers. Remember the old movie theater or movie?
Yes.
I guess they're still there, but they have this the Warner Brothers, and the way it's worded is Warner Brothers, if you see police, something like that. It's kind of tongue-in-cheek fun, but it talks about relationships and, that the black community has, or in some cases doesn't have, with local law enforcement, and, we're seeing examples of that in places like Ferguson, Missouri, and things of that nature, and I've had to tell people, and I've had this chat many years ago with my son, and also his friends and any other young black males that I get a chance to talk to, is that there's a way to conduct yourself if you get pulled over. I mean, it's a kind of talk that you have to have with your black male child that people don't normally have to have with their children, but we have to have that talk with our boy children, because it can be kind of hostile out there, and I think we're seeing that in today's world.
Exactly. Well, I want to go back a few years, right out of college. It seems you didn't venture that far from sports by becoming a sports anchor/reporter for 8 years. It seems that job allowed you to learn the business of TV reporting and management, as you were just mentioning. You went to Indiana College?
Illinois State.
Sorry. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, on the scholarship, and how was that?
Well, it's a great community. It's a university just south of Chicago. I grew up in northern Indiana in a city called Michigan City, Indiana, which is about 50 miles east of Chicago, and it's right along the lake, right between Gary and South Bend. And went to Illinois State University on an athletic scholarship. I was a basketball player, and I guess the way the kids say it nowadays, I had some game. I could play.
Okay, all right.
But I never lost contact with the educational aspect of the scholarship. I mean, I knew getting a degree was not an option for me, or not getting a degree was not an option for me, because that's why I went there. I wanted to, and I mentioned this in the book, that the educational aspects of it and the contacts that I would make along the way, I knew that that would serve me a lot longer than that basketball being dribbled or shot or whatever.
Right.
And, my undergraduate degree was in broadcast journalism and law. I wanted to be a lawyer as well.
Okay.
I just wanted to have these things in place. And, you know, it just allowed me, you know, the basketball, I didn't let the basketball use me. You know, so many young people, regardless of their color, they get caught up in their sport, and that's all they know to do. That's all they can do. And you can't play or do that forever. And I tell the kids that I talk to now, I said, even if you went on to be as good as Michael Jordan or LeBron James, you can only play till you're about 35. Look at Kobe Bryant now. I mean, he's great, but he is an old basketball player, but a young man, but a very young man. Now, I'm sure Kobe has done some good things with his money and has some things that he wants to do when he gets done, but you can't play forever. And one has to be careful about how much they of their time and their mind that they put in those athletic endeavors, because the body doesn't stay the same forever.
Yeah, exactly. And I know, I mean, I've read comments from Michael Jordan. I think he still thinks he wants to get out there and play, and it's the competitive nature in those athletes that they want to play forever. But unfortunately, as you said, you can't play forever.
No, that mind has you making that move or driving the baseline, but the body, legs just don't take you there anymore. And, you know, I think Kobe's finding that out now, as they all do, Hamp. And I always enjoy that quote where father time is undefeated. You better believe it.
Yeah. All right.
That is so true.
Yeah, you was a sports director for another station for almost 2 years, and how was it to perform your assigned duties in that environment as the boss, so to speak?
Well, you know, that's a high pressure industry, because you get pressure, and I go into that a great deal in the book. I talk about the parts of that industry that you don't see on the 6 and 10 o'clock news. I mean, you get pressures from the news director, the producer, the general manager. Everybody thinks you should have done something another way or a different way, or they have a story they want you to do, even though you supposedly are making the decisions in the department. But if a general manager comes you and his nephew is Johnny Jump Up out at the local high school, whether he can play or not, you have to kind of respect that. So those are some of the things that they don't teach you in journalism school, that you have to kind of navigate that ground a little bit.
Right.
And, you know, when I was coming up, you know, in the industry, and that's why I look at the on-air people nowadays, and I'm really proud of the new opportunities that are available to reporters of color, whether they be black, white, Hispanic, Asian, whatever, because back in our day, when I was coming up in that industry, everybody wanted you to look and sound like Brian Gumbel.
I mean complete
with a light complexion, and if your features were too strong or something like that, we couldn't get past the interview stage, or we couldn't get to the interview stage for some of these jobs.
Yeah.
And but the way that industry is, you can't accuse somebody or a company or a TV station of discrimination, because first of all, it's subjective and you can't prove it. Secondly, you can also torpedo your career if you start getting the reputation of suing TV stations for discrimination. So no one went there, you know. And that was a tough part. That's why I take so much pride and really enjoy watching very talented reporters of color. And I don't just say black. I'm talking about, you know, Asian and Hispanic. Watching them get the opportunity and watching them excel and do a great job.
Oh, yeah. It does us all good to see the diversity when we turn on our TV screen, I can tell you, you know, just as you're saying.
True.
Now, among other things, your interest is in authorship and encouraging aspiring writers to write. How did that come about?
Oh, wow. You know, that's an interesting road that I took. You know, I had a feeling, Hamp, that early on that I was living a great story. You know, I mean, I was surrounded by really good people doing really good things, and I thought, I didn't live it as though I was going to write a book about it, but I was remembering things. I would jot down a note or two. I wasn't sure that I had the skill to actually sit down and do a book. But it's funny where that once it is that you have acquired some of the literary skills that I have over my career, you start to sit down at that computer. Yeah, I almost said typewriter, but now it's a computer, and it starts to flow. It starts to flow from your brain through your fingers right onto the keyboard. And I started Swagger, the book Swagger, Life and Times of Rick Whitlow, in 2010. And the thing about that is that, I mean, I wrote very consistently for about 6 months. Then I set it aside for a couple years. literally. Mm-hmm. You know, because the story wasn't complete yet. There were still some things going on that needed to be in that book. Now, once I got to the point where I had written it, then you have to deal with the publishing part of it. Now, that's another animal because, you know, I decided to self-publish because I wanted control of my story. And to do that, you know, you do have to raise a little money on the front end, but you have control of your product. And I've encouraged writers, once again, black writers or writers of color, to consider self-publishing because that way you don't have anybody editing your story, you don't have anybody changing your story, and you don't have anybody who can tell you, well, this isn't good enough. No, you know, you never accept that because that's what the traditional publishers will do is say, well, it's not this enough. There's not enough violence in it or not enough sex in it or not enough this, that, or something else. But that's not what I'm writing about. And that's why so many writers get rejected or get discouraged with the process because you're constantly running into walls that tell you your work is not good enough. And I refuse to believe that. You know, I thought my story was good enough. I thought I could put it together good enough. And I didn't do it by myself. I mean, I have an editor, you know, and I had another set of eyes on things, looking at things and making sure that it's sharp. But when we got done with that project, I was very proud of it. And it sits on the shelves with all the other books looking fine, I think.
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean. Yeah. Okay, Rick, I'm going to give you a break here. We're going to take a musical break so you can gather your thoughts, and we're going to come back and talk about the book.
Okay, great. All right.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, here's a cut from the late, great George Duke. The song is from his last CD entitled Dreamweaver. The cut is self-explanatory, entitled Change the World. Voices, performing vocals you'll hear include Layla Hathaway, Jeffrey Osborne, Lori Perry, B.B. Winans, Daira Sagandi, Freddie Jackson, Terry Dexter, and Kennedy Fusilla. Although I played this song in our last show, for me, it also fits in with our topic of the day. And without further ado, here is Change the World by George Duke.
My main theme is the danger of nuclear weapons.
We are at a very critical point in American history.
As the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation.
Idealism is very important.
We can change the world.
We can change the world.
With all the problems we face in the world today, I know it's difficult to believe that a single person or a group of people can possibly make a difference. But every solution begins with a dream. And a dream is the substance of things hoped for, and hope put into action can be the beginning of something profound. My wish is that this song will uplift spirits and musically offer the positive messages that the world so desperately needs.
Gather around and talk a minute. What I have to say is quite simple. Very hard to do. What have we got to lose?
There are problems everywhere. See, my people just don't care enough to make a change. They keep on playing the same old game.
USA to Africa, Mexico to Indonesia. Imagine what we could be if we opened up our
wash away the bread.
We're back. Okay, Rick, your book is entitled, as you mentioned before, and I think I mentioned it at first too, it's called Swagger, The Life and Times of Rick Whitlow. Can you tell us a little bit about the book?
Well, yeah, Hamp, it starts off, of course, I'm from Michigan City, Indiana, which is in northern Indiana, just outside Chicago in between Gary and South Bend. And it starts out even sooner than that, where my mother and our people moved up north as part of that great black migration from Memphis, Tennessee. And my values are very southern. You know, I'm kind of my grandmother and relatives like that grew up in the South and came north looking for better opportunities, and they settled in Michigan City, which is an incredible, wonderful, at the time, high school basketball. You know, you've heard of the Hoosier hysteria. Well, my high school was right in the middle of it back in the 60s and 70s. It was a great place to grow up and play basketball. You know, we grew up not having very much, but not knowing that we didn't have very much, because we grew up in a community that was caring and loving like we were back in the 60s and 70s and even before that. And the thing that sticks with me so much through it as I think about my upbringing was in our neighborhood there were black men. There were men. You know, there weren't a lot of single mothers raising kids, and I think that matters a great deal as you form your values, you know, and as you get older. So being a pretty good athlete, you know, getting things done in high school, getting the college scholarship, and kind of following the sports area, it just created other opportunities. The book itself, it starts off talking about the athletic accomplishments, but it branches off into so many other areas and things that was made possible, that were made possible because of the discipline and the hard work ethic and things like that that I developed early in life because of how I was raised, because of the mentors, many of them men, who just insisted that you do the best that you can where you are with what you have. And that was kind of my theme in life. And have, you know, I as I speak to different groups, I always talk about this theory that I developed very early in life called the POET theory. And it's an acronym. The P stands for preparation, the O stands for organization, the E stands for effort, the first T stands for teamwork, and I even put in another T for time management. And those five things can create, you can be successful if you can master those five things in particular, or even three of those five things. You can be successful in almost any area you choose, you know, because you have to be prepared, you have to be organized, you have to put forth some effort, you have to be a part of a team, because nobody does it alone, and you also need to be careful how you manage your time. And that has served me very, very well as I've gone through things as a student, as an athlete, as a businessman, as a politician, as a reporter, whatever it is that I was doing. Those things served me very well, and they continue to do so today.
Okay. I believe the book is performing pretty good on the market, isn't it?
It is doing very well, very well. I've been very pleased with how it has performed, and the spreadsheet that I get on it every month, and I should be getting another one here in a couple of weeks. It does very well in the Chicago area, in my hometown area, also in my college community, and also I spent 5 years on the East Coast in my first TV job in a place called Plattsburgh, New York, which is nowhere near New York City. It's closer to Montreal, Quebec.
That's a great thing you
need
to know, huh?
Yeah, you didn't know. It's nowhere near New York City. It's upstate, northern New York. But ironically, Hamp, it gave me an opportunity to get major market experience because it was just south of the city of Montreal. And there's several chapters in the book where I talk about my 5 years in rural New York. But it was a strange market because Montreal, Quebec was just across the border. So I got a chance to cover Major League Baseball and get to know a lot of people who were with the Montreal Expos at the time. You know, people like Ellis Valentine and Andre Dawson and people like that. And it was a diamond in the rough because it gave me an opportunity to get major market experience early in my career. And, you know, I talk about a great opportunity that I had to develop a friendship with Pete Rose, Pete spent, and I go into detail about it in the book, Pete spent like 3 months, maybe even less than that, at the Montreal Expo. Many people don't realize that. Yeah, he it was just before he took the job, the field manager's job of the Cincinnati Reds, and before all the gambling thing happened. But Pete and I were very good friends, and you know, because of this job, and because of having an opportunity to be up there and work in an environment like that. So, you know, the broadcast career has been fabulous. I wouldn't trade it for anything because it's made so many other things possible. I know a lot of times I talk about the relationship that I've had, you know, with people in that industry. And there's some wonderful white people who have done some wonderful things for me, Hap. You know, and see, this is what I'm talking about, where you, as I tell people to try to be colorblind in it, but you can't be – colorblindness, I don't think, is something that you can acquire, but it's something you can try to be, because you're going to need people in whatever it is that you do. And regardless of what color they are, you know, you can help them and they can help you. And that's part of pulling together the teamwork.
Yeah, that's it. Do you think even today, and this has to do with the writing styles, that having or maybe even at some point developing a certain writing style helps one become a better writer?
I believe so, but I think the writing style has a way of finding you, you know, as you develop your fundamentals as a writer and as a reader, suddenly a style will find you. Because if I sat down and started trying to write like James Baldwin or somebody like that, I'm sure I would fall short of that if I was trying to imitate somebody like that. But if my fundamentals are sound, my reading, my writing, my understanding of the language, then a style will find me, or a style will find the author. And, you know, I'm looking forward to my next couple projects, and I'm not sure what they're going to be because, you know, I'm kind of a historical person. I like biographies. I like to write about real things and people and situations. And I'm looking for a style to find me as I go through that journey because, you know, my first book was about myself. I had to master me before I could start branching out doing other people. And I'm very satisfied with how that's come out. Now in living here in Atlanta, I have my top five hit list of people who I'm approaching about doing their biographies. And then my skill set's going to get tested a little bit because suddenly I'm writing about something that's not about me, but it's about somebody else. And I'm really looking forward to that challenge. But yeah, you know, I go into it with my fundamentals intact. You know, I mean, I know how to do this. I can read, I can write, I can research, I can process information. And that's where, you know, that's so important. That's where this education thing is so important, Hap. You know, I can't stress that too much to young writers, young students, young people, is that understand and master this language, and you can do anything with it. But you got to have that foundation, and other things will find you.
Yeah, exactly. I know you had mentioned something about self-publishing. Did you talk to a lot of self-publishing companies, or did the one you eventually selected blow you away with their knowledge and expertise?
Well, I did. They blew me away with their knowledge and expertise early on, but I knew I needed to shop around a little bit because there were some things that I needed and I wanted my publisher and publishing company to be able to do, and the company that I used is doing it masterfully. I needed some help with the cover design. You know, that's outside of my expertise. They did a great job with that. I needed help in the book format. They did a great job with that. I had a high school friend of mine who spent 40 years as an English literature teacher who was my editor. She did a wonderful, wonderful job. And also one of the things that I wanted to be conscious of is that as far as marketing it, I did not want them sending me 2,000 books and having turned in my garage into a storage
exactly,
house. My publisher, what they do is they call it print on demand. So as you order my book, you know, you can get it printed on demand and it can get to you in 2 days. You know, you know, I just did not want to turn my house into a book warehouse, and that was very, very important to me. Now, my strength was, after up on getting done with the book, my strength was marketing and promotions. Now, I can do that because that's the arena from which I come. You know, I mean, I have media contacts. You know, I can reach out to people and I can talk about the product itself. That's where I was very, very good at. Now, my publisher would do that for you too, but just like all companies will do, they will upsell you. I mean, you don't have to buy everything they pitch to you.
Right.
You know, there are some
right.
things you can do on your own. And the marketing and promotions and public relations part of it, that was right down my alley. I can do that. So I've taken that
and
on
one
myself.
One of the most important.
No, yeah.
And sorry for interrupting, but I'm just saying, agreeing with you, and one of the most important, that's all.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. You have to work at it. You know, sometimes I read these blogs and people are disappointed with whoever they're working with because they didn't do enough marketing. You have to do it yourself. Sometimes the writers, they will say, well, all they did was, you know, I didn't hear from them anymore. Well, you probably won't, but they don't market it per se like you would maybe market it yourself. Sometimes people just want to write a book, throw it out there, and then wait for the royalty checks to roll in, and it doesn't happen like that. it really doesn't. You have to promote it yourself.
Yeah, and then you got to promote it to other people. I mean, other people than your cousins and uncles and all that stuff. I mean, those people are going to be pat you on the back. Oh, very nice, very nice. But you got to think, when you're thinking of marketing, you got to think of people who don't know you that might want to read the book and how to approach them. Okay.
Exactly, because after a while you run out of family and friends.
Exactly, very quickly.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, let's relax and take another musical break. For our audience, we are featuring the late, great Wayman Tisdale Hangtime CD on this show. The CD was released in 2004. Here is the title cut. It's in called Hangtime by Wayman Tisdale.
Thank you.
all right, we're back.
Let me mention something. As you just played that, many people may not know that Wayman Tisdale was an outstanding basketball player.
Exactly.
He went to the University of Oklahoma and was a first-round draft pick of the Indiana Pacers and also played many years in the NBA. And he's a perfect example of how it is he had something else to fall back on, even though his life ended too soon. But he had something else to fall back on that he used very, very well, you know, his entire life. So Wayman Tisdale, very, very much aware of him.
Exactly. Yeah, I didn't want to I wanted to give a narrative about it, but I just didn't want to go because he did so many things. All I know is he was a, you know, in addition to everything else, being a basketball and playing for the Sacramento Kings, he was an excellent bassist. That's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You have to have something else to do. That's for sure.
That's right. I've got every one of his albums. I actually saw him. Well, I won't go into that, but let's just go on. That's why I didn't want to get into it because, you know, we talk about it. I love music, and I love great music players, who, you know, people who can do that. So, you know, I was surprised when I heard some of his music and I saw him play, you know. So.
Very diverse.
Yeah. There's an ad out there from the co-creator of Chicken Soup for the Soul. They have a video on how to write a book. They are offering it free. Are you familiar with the book and author?
Well, I'm not real familiar with it. I know I have heard of them before, and I didn't have a lot of information on them, but it's an interesting service they offer.
Yeah. And where I was going with this is what do you think of their claim to be able to help an aspiring author write, as they put it, how to write a great book and make a big difference? What do you think of that concept?
Yeah, that one's I'm not real sure of, Ham, because I don't know that you can teach somebody to write a great book and have big success on it. You know, because if you can't write, you can't write. You know, if you can't read, you can't write. And you know, to put out the claim that, well, come with us and we're going to show you how to come up with a bestseller, I don't know that it's that kind of. That'd be like me telling you, you know, come on to my basketball camp, I'm going to make you an NBA star.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Yeah, that's kind of a reach. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say all five put five of me. Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. But if there is that they are able to help people develop fundamentals about how to do it, then I think that it would be something that's very well worth its while and worth looking into. But I would stop short of ever telling anybody that, you know, come, I'm going to show you how to become a best-selling author and help you have a successful book, because the industry just doesn't work like that. And, you know, because you don't know how hard somebody's going to work at it. You know,
that's right.
You know, you have to put forth the effort. I can give you a blueprint of almost anything, but if you can't, you know, if you can't drive to the basket and dunk, then I can't teach you that. If you're just 5'2" and 120 pounds, you know.
Yeah, and
so
it seems to be. Go ahead.
No, so I don't know. It would be something that I would, you know, I'd be interested in finding out more about. But you know, if you can't write, you can't write. But you can help.
Yeah,
you can become a better reader, maybe.
Right. I know I was looking on LinkedIn and saw another narrative thread, and this one was about the inspiration formula. In other words, this person claimed that they can give you, I mean, there's a formula for inspiration, and you go, what? You know. But I will say, in the same narrative, they did say something that was very right. I mean, a very, very well received by me, or I thought that was very accurate. They said in order to succeed as a writer, you have to become a business person. And I think you might agree with that, wouldn't you?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, because there's a business part of it that kicks in on you really, really quickly, because you know, you have to have a business plan. You know, you have to have some kind of an idea about how to form this idea, how to execute it, and then how to market it and promote it and get it out there. So that's all good businesses do that. And if you're going to be a successful writer and author, you know, those are things that you either have to be able to do yourself or have some people around you that you trust who can do it for you.
Yeah. And, well, to my listeners, and just as a small editorial for me, I know that some people can get excited when getting all the inside information, so to speak, on how to succeed and wind up never succeeding. One of the main reasons is because they tend to get wrapped up and confused while trying to follow the latest instructions and secrets in accomplishing their goal from the so-called experts. You know what I mean?
That's true.
That is not to say that this video offered by that we were talking about by these people would not help them. But I am a great proponent of following your own intuition, if you can trust it. Realize theirs is an opinion, not the absolute, as you said, in other words. That's all I'm saying. Stay on course with what you are trying to do. And above all things, don't let your creativity get bogged down with so-called expert advice. Think that would be good advice for somebody?
Right, you are so right. That's absolutely right. And not to be discouraged. And see, I know one of the things that we were going to talk about is the conventional and traditional publishers. I have a problem with them because, first of all, I don't think they respect my talent, and I don't think they respect my story. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I'm not going to have them tell me that it's not this enough, it's not that enough. You don't know enough about the story that I'm telling, and you don't respect it enough, and you don't respect my talent to be able to tell it. And that's why, you know, authors and writers of color in particular, you know, unless you're a celebrity, I mean, you know, sure, you know, a high profile actor, athlete, they can spit out a book, you know, in 6 months. But unless you are Toni Morrison or Terry McMillan or somebody like that, you know, they don't give you don't get the same kind of shot, you know. And I wasn't going to sit around waiting for a traditional publisher to cut up my story and then tell me it's not good enough. No, I wasn't going to do that.
Exactly.
Now with that said, Hamp, if a publisher called me and gave me a 6-figure advance to write 3 books in the next couple of years, then we can talk.
Exactly.
Then we can talk. But I'm not going to send my manuscript to you and have you get back to me in a year and a half and then tell me it's not good enough. And, you know, no, I'm not going to do that.
Right, but the scenario you just described, at least you're able to negotiate with the publisher because he's calling you, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. But I know you mentioned this before, but I'm going to ask it again. What do you think are some of the basic requirements a writer must have before beginning a project?
Yeah, I think you have to... You have to trust yourself and have well, first of all, it gets back to the fundamentals of reading and writing, you know, and again, that gets into the educational aspect. This is why I tell kids and students to take this educational thing seriously early on, because it's going to be at you, it's going to come at you every day of your life. You know, if you can't read, you won't be able to write. If you can't write, you won't read. You know, and so much of what goes on, even online and things like that, you got to be able to understand, read, write this language correctly before it is that you can articulate it in a book form. If I were talking to a young person in the 5th or 6th grade now, I always get on them about making sure that you are reading. I don't care what you read, read something. You know, then that'll help you become a better speller. It will help you become a better speaker. It will help you become, obviously, a better writer. But you gotta, you have to embrace this knowledge that's going to come at you every day in so many different ways. That's where you start, is being fundamentally sound with your reading and writing. And that starts in school.
Okay. And what about the selection of subject matter? I know you touched on that a little bit, you know.
Write about what you're interested in, you know, or I mean, even if it's nonfiction. I mean, I work with some kids now who have great ideas about these video games and their imaginations and they're interested in fictional things. There are people who write great books that are fictional. You know, and if you have that kind of imagination again, and if it is that you have put together your knowledge from a fundamental standpoint, writing and reading, sit down and create something. You know, you're creative. Mm-hmm. Put it on paper and pick it that way. I mean, if you're into sports or history or biography or singing and dance and entertainment, whatever, I mean, write about something that you're interested in. That will help your creative juices and your energy keep, help you sustain that. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. And I know you mentioned that it took you 2 years to write yours, but I mean, not really took you 2 years because you had set it down after 6 months. But mm-hmm. What do you think? When do you think a potential writer should begin writing? I mean,
yeah. Early on in life, and when I say early on, I'm talking about it in elementary school because, you know, you start writing, even if it's just term papers. I mean, that's the foundation that you get to before it is that you know, I don't think there's many sixth graders, seventh graders who are going to sit down and say, I'm going to write a book today. But they can sit down and work on their fundamentals that will help them write a book in 10 years.
Right.
You know, or 15 years. It's about developing good habits. It's about developing those fundamentals that I talk about. And it's also about not quitting. And I understand and believe in that writer's block. Sometimes I'd sit down and wouldn't have a thought in my head. You know, you just hit a wall. And that's a creative writer will step back from it a little bit, maybe wake up in the middle of the night with a note or something comes to them in mind. They might have a notepad on their nightstand. Write it down. You know, and organize that thought later the next day. And you can do that at any age, even if it's about the term paper that you're writing about as an eighth grader. But those that is when it is that you start to develop those fundamentals that I talk about. So it is that you will be prepared to write a book when you're ready. I mean, you know, when I started writing mine, I was, 57 years old, 58 years old. You know, I mean, I didn't roll out of bed as a high school senior saying, I'm going to write this book. You know, but the experiences and my fundamentals and my aptitude for wanting to know about things and produce something, it came together when I was 57.
So it's about, I guess the answer to the question is it's never too early and it's never too late.
No, absolutely not. It's never too early to start preparing, and it's never too late to start putting it on, making it happen. You just have to stick with it and believe in your talent and believe in what you're writing about.
Okay, yeah, all right. All right, I'm going to take another break here and play another record so you can sort of collect yourself. Here's a little formation of ideas music, so to speak. It's another musical selection from the great late Waymon Tisdale's Hangtime CD. He covers a Smokey Robinson tune here. It's called Cruisin'.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Rick.
Wow. Wayman Tisdale was a bad boy, Hamp.
Hey, I'm trying to tell you. That's why I didn't want to, you know, I'm so grateful that you came in and filled our audience in and who he was, because I didn't have that, and I knew it would take me a long time to try to do that. Because he was such a talented individual.
Oh, and, yes,
and
he was.
In addition to thinking of how he left us here, so, you know, it's just a sad story, but he left behind a hell of a legacy. So.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
Yeah. I want to go back to the publishing end of it, and I want to ask you, what do you see as some of the obstacles an author of color may run into when trying to decide upon their method of publishing a book?
Well, I think what they run into, and not they, but we, what we run into with that is...
Yeah.
Is getting our story in front of people, having them take it seriously, and having them respect our ability to tell it.
Yeah.
And you know, that as I said a little earlier, unless you're a celebrity writer or somebody like that, and you know, who has somebody ghostwriting for you and you can just, you know, jot down some stuff and they publish it. Those of us who are out here in the trenches trying to get our work on shelves and places that it needs to be to sell, I mean, the traditional publishing industry does not take the black story seriously.
Right.
And I don't think they respect it enough to trust us with our story or our idea. And that's why they so often they send it back to you, you know. And I didn't have a year and a half for somebody to be scouring over my work, telling me what I should have said or could have said or might want to say. No, I wanted control of my product. And that's why I did it the way I did. And the only thing that would cause me to change it is that if one of the big boys in the publishing industry called with a six-figure offer and wanted me to do something else, but I wouldn't change my current work. No.
Mm-hmm.
But that's
well,
what
the
that's
good part. No, go ahead.
No, that's what a minority writer, or even as a woman writer, may run into. You know, just that the traditional publishing companies don't. You know, they don't. Do your work justice, and that's why it's easy now with the newfound popularity of self-publishing. You can do an end run around them. You know, you don't really need them to get your books out there. I mean, it's even getting to the point where you almost don't even need a bookstore.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
because exactly. Online and the bookstore, they want to take such a big percentage of things. I have not dealt with bookstores because I don't want to give them 40-55% of the profits. No, not when I can do it online.
And the other thing I wanted to mention too is that when you do self-publishing, you know, you still, I mean, and you should do it this way, is that the contract you enter with the self-publisher still leaves you an out to go to a brick-and-mortar publisher, so to speak, if they're interested.
Right. That's right. That freedom of choice and the freedom to have control of your product at all times.
Yeah. That's it in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm.
So do you see an issue with an author using a vanity publisher? And the vanity publisher is what we're talking about, these self-publishing companies. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really don't, and that's the way I'm going to go until there's something happens that causes me to do something else. You know, so the traditional industry wants to try to portray self-publishers and self-publishing as an inferior product, and it's not. Sure, there are some writers who are better than others, both in traditional publishing and non-traditional publishing. I mean, that's going to be the case. But, you know, if you control your product and you have – you know, sound fundamentals again, and have a good vision, and have some help in areas that you are not expert in, your product can look as good as any product in the bricks and mortar bookstores. You know, sometimes, like I said, the cover is so important. That's why I got help with the cover, because I'm not a graphic artist. You know, I wouldn't have known how to put together that. That was worth the extra cost to me for my publisher, for them to put together a very solid and strong cover, which they did. And that cover is now, you know, kind of my brand out there, my footprint in online, and I'm proud of it. They did a wonderful job.
They really did. I like it, too. And obviously, as you're alluding to, the cover is your calling card. You know, nobody's going to pick up the book and say, well, since Random House didn't publish this and he went to whoever, I don't want to buy this book. They're looking at, you know, the interesting title, or if the, you know, the title, the interest in the content, and the cover is what attracts them to pick up the book in the first place.
Yes, it does. That is so true. That is absolutely true, and that should be top priority. You know, when you're talking to publishers, both traditional and non-traditional, just got to have a strong cover. That's very important.
Yeah. Do you sort of accept the fact that you might not sell as well as some of your more famous white or black authors, for that matter, because of the decline in overall readership?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Hamp, because, you know, our society has gotten such that, you know, people just don't seem to find or want to have the time to sit down and read anything. You know, but I think if it's an interesting subject matter, and that depends. I mean, not everybody is interested in what I'm writing about, you know, or what I may write about next year. But if it is that you can tap into a niche, you know, or a culture of people who believe in your work, who like what they've seen in your work, and will give your work a chance, and who want to see it, you know, who want to read it again, you can do well. I didn't do this to be ready to retire. You know, I mean, you know, I'm not Ernest Hemingway.
Exactly.
Yeah. But I did know and think that I had an interesting story, and I had a target marketing audience that I thought would find it very interesting, and I've been right about that. What I will do next, I don't know. You know, I'm not sure. I have many ideas, but I think that now that I do have a reputation as a writer and a published author, that people who, you know, who see my work for the first time will be interested in the second project and maybe the third, and we go right on down the line.
See, and that's that can't be stressed enough, because I know when I wrote my book, my first book was about the time I spent in Korea. The second book was about my grandmother, and since I like history so much, I took it back to the 1917-1953 format. But the point is that I didn't write the book because I thought it was going to be a bestseller, this, that, and the other. I wanted my story out so that my people, my cousins and kids, and would know what it took for those people to go through a segregated South in order to, and so that we may be here, you know? So that was the story I was trying to tell. And so, like I say, you know, oftentimes we don't go into it for the money or the fame. We're there for the love of it all, right?
Yes, and to document where you've been and what you've done. You know, you talk about the segregated South. Some of the people that I admire and respect the most, I had an opportunity to work with and be around when I was in the South. Now, keep in mind, I'm from the North, and I spent 25 years in Jackson. And this is not a sports book, but it has a sports backdrop. I tell stories about Grambling University, Eddie Robinson there, James Meredith, who was the first black to enroll in Ole Miss. He and I are good friends. He and I used to sit and talk many times, and his stories are great. Charles Evers, who is the brother of Medgar Evers, he lives in Jackson. He and I are good friends. He and I sat and talked many times. And those stories like that transcend sports and politics and social things, these people are all in the book, as well as the sports people. You know, somebody like Walter Payton, you know, I talk about a story about him. And I know before we went on the air, Jerry Rice, good friend of mine from Mississippi, you know, and these some of these are non-football stories, but they're about people who are athletes. So the southern part, and I think I call it in the book, it's called Make My Stand in Dixieland, Look Away, Look Away. That's the chapter of the book. Yeah.
I like
so so there's people like that in the book that, you know, that are sporty but not I mean, Eddie Robinson tells great stories that are outside of the sports arena. I mean, you know, he talks about, you know, if it is that he would have had a chance to coach at LSU. My college basketball coach, Hamp, is a guy by the name, it's a guy by the name of Will Robinson. He was the first black coach at a major university. And he didn't get that job till he was 58 years old. And he once at a convention, people said, well, Coach, you think it was because you were too old that you didn't get the job? His answer was, no, it wasn't because I was too old. It was because I was too black.
Yeah.
And you could have heard a pin drop in the convention hall when he said that.
But he,
you know, those are the kind of stories that I tell in this book that I think people find very interesting that are non-sports stories. They're social stories. They're people stories.
Yeah.
And I had a great time putting it together.
Yeah, and people like that, they don't give up, you know. They don't
smoke
and go hide and stuff because they can't get something done. I mean, you just have to keep on moving.
Yes, you do. Keep moving forward.
Keep on pushing.
For sure.
That's right. Yeah, so I'm going to be looking for my autographed copy. I don't know how I'm going to get that, but, you know, maybe I have to get the book and then send it to you. You send it back to me so we can exchange books in that respect, you think?
Well, absolutely. Let's make it a point to do that. It'll be kind of my gift to you, my Christmas gift to you. How about that? Let me put the website out there real quick so other people can get it.
Oh, no, I'm going to do that. No, you're not going anywhere. Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
You're coming back. You're coming back. But I do want to ask you a political question here. I mean, you could take it for what it's worth, but I have to ask it anyway because I'm a political junkie, so to speak. Although I can't watch it every day, I have to get away from it because it pisses me off. So I just have to tell you that.
So, I understand.
But finally, do you have any comments on this GOP majority in both houses that this country finds itself in for the next couple of years?
Well, you know, it's going to be very difficult for President Obama, they've already made it very difficult for him to begin with. You know, I think he's strong enough where that his mentality would be, okay, if we're not going to share the wealth, then we're going to share the pain. And he's the kind of person, I think, that's probably going to stand his ground on this, and there'll be gridlock, but he is still the president of the United States, and because of the executive order, the executive order that he can put through, he can create, you know, if they want a mess, he can help them create a mess. You know, he can govern by veto, and that seems to be the way he's going to go about it, or that they're going to put him in a position where he's going to have to go about it that way, or cave, and he doesn't strike me as being the kind of person who's going to cave into him.
Yeah, I got the feeling from watching his post-election press conference that, you know, he was peeved because, you know, only one-third of the people voted, for one thing, and the other thing is that... you know, he just, I mean, he knows that he's put some good ideas. Now, this is not to say he hasn't fumbled and hasn't did, you know, things that maybe shouldn't have been done that way and had people in his administration that went ways that shouldn't have been gone. I mean, that happens in every presidential administration. But the man has done some wonderful things, and he doesn't get credit for it.
Yeah, he absolutely has, and I think the history books will be kinder to him in years to come.
Yeah.
But, you know, I often tell people that if conservative Republicans are mad at Barack Obama, wait till they get a load of Hillary.
Yeah.
You know, and after her, Elizabeth Warren. You know, Elizabeth Warren. And, the Republicans are just, I think, you know, the demographics are such that they are going to have a difficult time winning a national election. You know,
and they know that too, and that's why they're aiming to change the voting laws and all that other stuff. So,
right, that's true.
We don't want to get too past, you know, because that's a whole new show.
Yeah, that's another show.
Stay with me, Rick.
Okay.
As I said, I want to take another musical break, and you can come back with me, and then we can talk a little bit more. Ladies and gentlemen, here's another cut from the late great Wayman Tisdale, Hangtime CD entitled Everything for You. Just hold on with me, y'all. all right, Brother Wick. Brother Wick. Jesus Christ, I can't even talk. It must be getting late. Brother Rick, will you give our audience your contact information now so they can get in touch with you?
Absolutely. I can be reached at rick.whitlow@gmail.com. That should read R-I-C-K dot W-H-I-T-L-O-W at gmail.com. And my website for the book is outskirtspress.com/swagger. That's outskirtspress.com/swagger. Or you can go to Amazon, put my name in, or any place where books are sold online. It'll come up.
Okay. All right. All right. Hey, it's been a ball, man, and I hope very informative to someone out there who may be thinking of writing. We will certainly have you back sometime next fall, if that's okay with you.
Oh, absolutely, Hamp, anytime. I enjoy chatting with you, and we can talk at any time.
Oh, yeah. Or I should say, if not sooner, to see how things are going. I guess I'll have to let you go now. I mean, I've held you long enough, and you've certainly put out some information that I think is going to be well-received by our audience. And as I said before, I hope people get an idea of what it is to sit down and, you know, and that would go with the fundamentals and everything it entails in order to write a book.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Read and write. That's where the knowledge is reading and writing. And I would encourage people to do both those things as often as they can, as well as they can.
All right. Thanks again, Rick, for being you. Good luck with your book entitled Swagger, The Life and Times of Rick Whitlow, and all your other endeavors. Tell my friends and kinfolk in the ATL I said hello.
I will do it. Send us a winter coat. It's getting cold down here, but we'll make it through.
I heard that. You take it easy now, and I'll check with you later.
Okay, Ham, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, thanks.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, bye. All right, ladies and gentlemen, my last word for today is the notice that a stupidity virus has been discovered to affect people. I'm serious. Check my Facebook or Twitter page and read all about it. Maybe that explains this next story. I know that you know China is a communist country who has violated many of their countrymen's basic human rights for decades. We know that workers earn what is considered a pittance even in China. That continues to allow the country to steadily enlarge its export market share of products we use on a day-to-day basis. Some in the government suspect the country of attempting to steal American technology and Defense Department secrets. I mean, it's China, folks. I'm not talking about the average Chinese public. I'm talking about China's ruling hierarchy, which is the Chinese government. Now, all of a sudden, I don't know if it's because they know that Putin and Obama can't stand each other. That's Putin from the USSR. We all know that Putin was the instigator of this sentiment. I don't know if they see him as a lame duck president, especially taking into account our last midterm election or what. Somehow, the Chinese government took offense because President Barack Obama was chewing gum walking through the airport on the way to the meetings. Let me repeat. They were upset because they wanted to keep these meetings on a formal basis, so they got upset at our president for chewing gum while walking through their airport upon his arrival for the meetings. And that is not the crux of it all. The American press sought to make a big deal of the chewing gum affair. They are leading off or reporting it in national and local news. By now, we should all know that most of the American press is still about shock and awe news, or the juicier, the better. Wow. No wonder the president seems annoyed by all this outside noise that has nothing to do with the issues at hand. Frankly, we ought to send him a 2-year supply of gum. He is going to need a lot of it to calm his nerves. We will end our tribute today, for the late, great Wayman Tisdale by playing off into it. Also from the Hang Time CD. Once again, here is Off Into It. Enjoy. Folks, we are going to wrap this puppy up now. I want to thank our guest, Rick Whitlow, and everyone who participated in today's show. As always, we meet here at the corner on a bi-monthly basis. I am your host, Curtis Hampton II. Just so you and the audience know, you have a chat room here. You can even chat amongst yourself while you're waiting as our guest for myself. But since we always sprinkle our show by adding a cut to my favorite artist, let us know your favorite, and I will try to get them in. If there are any comments, post them right on the show's comment section. Special guest Rick Whitlow, also a swagger, Life and Times of Rick Whitlow, gave me his contact information. If you want to contact him directly, that's great. I wish you would. We're out. See you next time, folks.